Good morning. 6:31 a.m. on June 7th, 2012. I got way too involved in Blog World Expo yesterday in the tweeters. It was, I kept needing to turn it off. It didn't help that I also had a couple of chores that took up a good portion of what is normally my morning writing time. I needed to get the lawn mowed. It hadn't been done since before I went to Balticon, and I've been back a week, and yeah, needed to get it done. It was quite a struggle, but I did get through it, so I had to do some internal, inside chores, and that took more time. But basically, I pretty much lost the day yesterday because of Blog World Expo, and the anger. I'm surprised at how angry. Is that right? Was I angry? I was frustrated. I was completely flummoxed by what I saw as a huge amount of silliness being passed off and retweeted and referenced as good advice, as good information, as how people should be relating to social media. The one that started the day off was social media isn't a sprint, it's a marathon. And as the day went on, I started replying to people, meet me at the finish line, I'll tell you why you're wrong. The guy who actually said it in his presentation started to follow me very shortly thereafter. He hasn't actually spoken to me yet, but it's a rather troublesome idea. But it goes back to the notion that social media, from a business aspect, should have identifiable goals and objectives. And yeah, I've got a business administration degree. I understand this idea of goals and objectives in terms of your standard production model of business. I also understand that if I approach social media from the perspective of goals and objectives, I miss something really important about social media. It's sort of like opening a storefront, opening a shop. And how do you present yourself at that storefront? And the problem is that if all you care about is the first time buyer, if all you care about is this mass market message, where you only really care if some tiny percentage of people who get your message respond to it favorably, if that's all you care about, then it makes a certain amount of sense. It makes perfect sense, actually. The problem is that in social media, and I've said this I don't know how many times on this podcast, social media isn't mass market. It's micro market. It's niche market. It's relying on a large portion of the fan base, the customers, to not only respond to this message, but the next message, and the next message, and the next message. They don't seem to get the idea that if you're selling yourself, your product, your service, whatever, you're at the same time creating a relationship with your customers that precludes them, not entirely, but to a large degree, precludes them from being your fans. Now, I know there are fans. There are people who are fans of brands. There are people who, you know, they're Ford junkies or they're Chevy bigots or whatever. But I don't think most people who buy Fords or most people who drive Chevys share that level of fandom. In part because those brands, and they are brands, are not micro market. They're not niche market. They're set up to be mass market brands. And that works, sort of, for them. United Airlines has some interesting problems because their brand is one that's associated with breaking guitars, losing luggage, and generally being complete assholes at the point of contact with the customer. Now, I've actually had nice relationships with interactions with customer service people who I've treated with respect. And yet, when I was in Chicago, I ran into two examples in a row of customer service people who really, they really need to have an adjustment made. The first lady was on the gate for a plane going to Seattle, and the plane was not in. It was late, held up by weather. It was a common problem that morning. And I said, I need to get on a plane to Denver. I missed my connection, and I need to know where I was booked. And she looked at my boarding pass and said, well, if you just stay right here, as soon as the plane to Seattle comes in, I'll make sure that you get on. It's like, no, I don't want to go to Seattle. I need to go to Denver. I missed my connection. She says, well, I don't know where Denver is. This is the gate for Seattle. I don't know where Denver is. Okay. That's an appropriate response. Not at all. Particularly since it wasn't like there was a huge herd of people standing in line waiting for me to get done with my business so that she could attend them. She was standing there behind the counter with no one around. The second one was I actually went to the gate that was boarding a flight to Seattle, and the gate attendant there was calling for standby passengers. And the standby passenger guy said, I'll deal with you in a minute. I need to get this flight off. And I said, no, I need to be on this flight. And he said, well, you aren't on my list, so I have to work on my list. Now, this is a guy who is calling standby passengers for empty seats on a flight that's going my way. It is boarding. I am standing there. I am ready to go. His response was, I need to get this flight out of here before I can deal with you. Go talk to customer service. Now, that was a bit of a problem. That was the one that I had the most trouble with, because while I can accept that the woman from Seattle might have been completely clueless, the fact that here is a gate attendant who is boarding standby passengers when faced with a ticket-holding customer gave standby priority. That shouldn't have happened at all. So that's a bit of an issue. But that's the idea of mass market. That's the idea of some of these people that were touting this notion. And the other one was just completely erroneous, totally screwed up logical data. It was in a presentation by Jason Falls about the importance of optimizing your website for mobile access. And I don't have any problem with that notion. I think it's a really important idea. In fact, I think all of my sites have or will have a mobile option, even if it's not perhaps the best. The reality of this is that what he presented was started out with the notion of a fact, which he cited no source on, but which is 9% of all visits to the web are to a website are on mobile. Now, I think that's a suspicious number right there, because I think it really depends on what your website is. I think it really depends on what your market is. For example, Deborah Geary's website has been optimized for Kindle access because she has a link at the back of each of her books that points people to her website, which is where they can find more stuff that she's done. So clicking on that link on a Kindle and going to that site sort of requires people to, required her to create a Kindle-friendly version, a mobile-friendly version. And she did. And her traffic is approaching 30 to 40% via Kindle. So for her, the 9% number was totally erroneous. But then he followed it up with what I can only best describe as hyperbole, masquerading as statistics. Because very closely following that, with the statement, 80% of your visitors will leave your site forever if you are not enabled via mobile. Or if you're not mobile enabled, forget now what that, you know, if you don't have a mobile site. Now, my question to Jason Fallis is, how do they know? If less than 10% of the people who visit your site on mobile, why would 80% of the people who visit your site leave? According to his numbers, 70% of the people who come to your site who would fall into the category of people who would leave don't have any way of finding out that your site isn't mobile enabled. That doesn't make sense. It doesn't make any sense at all. So yeah, I can accept that the 9% of people who visit on mobile and get an unsatisfactory experience would leave your site and never come back. I can understand that. But why would 71% more people who visit your site leave it? And how would they even know? And yet, I saw the link to this presentation get retweeted what had to be at least 100 times. At least 100 times. It was as bad as the 7 deadly sins of social media that was retweeted the day before what seemed like every other tweet from somebody was this idea that there are 7 deadly sins of social media. And I looked at the link. It's actually, you know, that's not nothing terrible there. It was all good stuff. And amusingly packaged around the 7 deadly sins. And seriously, you know, this is the best. This is what people paid, what was it, $1,200 a ticket for? And it wasn't quite there. There was one presentation that got a lot of attention yesterday about email lists and how that particular presenter, and I don't even know who it was anymore, thought that email was the center of your business. And the email list was the key to the center of the business, because that's how you reach out to people most effectively. That's how you get your messages heard. And another... there were a couple of people who at least turned a skeptical eye on that. And one of them posted a follow-up question to Twitter, which was, do you believe that the email list is central to your business? And I responded, and several others did too, that no. Well, it's an important channel for communications, and I'm growing my list by several people every single day. The reality is that the center of my business is my customers. It's not the channel that I use to reach them. And this was sort of like a, oh, that makes sense. bicycle chains to a tree with a big chain and a padlock. There's no house, not in the yard, on the tree that's beside the road. Anyway, so yeah, Blog World Expo, which will be New Media Expo, NMX, in Vegas, I think in January, and I'll be going there for that. I will be attending that as a panelist. I will be taking my strange ideas of marketing and social media. And I need to go through the tweets and find the myths I want to explode when I get there. Those two. A marathon, not a sprint. No, it's not a marathon. No, it's not a sprint. The notion that there's actually a difference between micro-marketing and mass marketing, and that using mass market tools in a micro-market channel is problematic. You need to take that. And the 96.3% of all statistics on the internet are made up on the spot. I really question some of the numbers that people are tossing about. Like, where did that come from? Speaking of numbers, there's a new Bowker report out on the growth of books in 2011. And given that 2012 is about half hour, that's just about the right amount of time for them to actually crunch the data. What's wrong with that picture? Anyway, Dean Wesley Smith has a post up this morning about how great it is that paper is not going away. The production of paper versions has gone up by 6% over the course of 2011. And my take on that was, really? So small? Only 6%? And the reason, according to the Bowker article that's referenced, is self-publishers account for the entire growth in the number of titles that have been issued in paper. Now, the other thing is that Dean, for all that he's a pretty savvy guy, and I admire him greatly, really has this fixation in his head that books that are provided in paper get sold in bookstores. And while the number of 80% of all books are still being sold in paper, it's probably, I don't know, and I'd really like to see some validation of that number. I'll let it stand for the moment, because an awful lot of books get sold in paper via textbooks. Colleges across this country sell millions and millions of units every year in paper, because that's how textbooks are published, that's how textbooks are distributed, that's how textbooks are used. And yet the largest segment in the Kindle store is nonfiction, go figure. Anyway, so this causal relationship between the release of paper and being available in bookstores is not clear to me. It's not 100% obvious to me that those two are connected at all. And the idea that only 6% growth based on all of the new ebook titles that are coming out. Now keep in mind that self-publishers publish about 1 million titles a year last year, and that the mainstream press only published about 378,000. So for 6% of the growth in new titles to be coming from self-publishing, when self-publishing is three times bigger in terms of raw numbers of titles being produced, that seems like a really small number. And I think part of it is that a lot of people are publishing titles in ebook form that are short stories, novellas, things that don't go well in paper because the cost of printing, the cost of the paper itself, the cost of shipping, rapidly exceeds the price of the book, or the value of the book. So if I have a 10,000 word short story, I put it in paper and I have to charge $7 for it, or $4 for it. I can charge $4.95 for a full novel. Huh? You know, there's a problem. There's a bit of a problem. And of course, it's not $4.95 for the paperback version. That's $12. It's $4.95 for the ebook. I don't only sell 99 cents for it. Only sell the ebook for 99 cents. So selling the paper version for $4 seems out of line. I don't know. Call it. I'm probably not quite rational on that subject, but that's how I feel about it. But this notion that so many people who are publishing now are not publishing paperback versions, and I find that very curious. I find that exceptionally curious. Oh, well, now that's interesting. The zone that in my irrigation system that has been not working suddenly appears to be. This is good, because that means that whatever was clogging up that solenoid has freed itself. Good, excellent. Anyway, I've made my loop. I'm at the back gate. Tomorrow's another day. And as almost always, I'll talk to you then.